Welcome to the Accenture MIT podcast series. Here's Daniel Jackson, professor of computer science at MIT.
Around 1798, an inventor called Eli Whitney put on a demonstration for the United States Congress. He took 10 guns and disassembled them, put all the parts in a big pile, mixed the pile up, and then reassembled the guns. To us today, this isn't such a remarkable feat, at least if you know how to take a gun apart and put it back together again. But the congressmen were quite amazed. What was the novelty? Well, back in the 18th century, no two guns were made with exactly the same parts. Even if they had the same designs and were supposed to be identical, there would be small differences between them, and a part taken from one gun would not generally fit in another. This meant that if your gun broke, you couldn't just go and buy a part to replace it. The whole gun had to be taken for repair or replaced. It also meant that if you were in the business of making guns, you couldn't hire a bunch of people and give them each a task of making a single part, as the parts they made wouldn't fit together properly. Eli Whitney's big idea was interchangeable parts, the idea that you could manufacture large numbers of parts that were, if not identical, close enough to each other to be interchangeable in any situation. Either none of them would fit, or all of them would. Actually, Whitney didn't invent the idea of interchangeable parts, and a Frenchman called Honoré Blanc had been producing guns with interchangeable parts 20 years earlier. Mass production with interchangeable parts was first achieved in shipbuilding at the British Naval Docks in Portsmouth by Marc Isambard Brunel, father of the more famous engineer Isambard Kingdom Brunel, and from there it spread to all manufacturing industries. Along with mechanized power and division of labor, the idea of interchangeable parts was what made the Industrial Revolution possible. To make the idea of interchangeable parts work, you need two technological innovations. The first is to be able to make large numbers of parts reliably with the same characteristics. The second innovation that you need is specifications. Instead of designing a machine with a rough sketch and jiggling the parts until they fit together, you have to come up with a design that has a precise description called a specification for each part. Then you can build the parts, and hopefully, if you did both of those steps correctly, everything will fit together nicely. What's the relevance of all this to software? Mass production is, of course, the easy part in software development. A software product in 1987 included the following warranty. Cosmotronic Software Unlimited, Inc. does not warrant that the functions contained in the program will meet your requirements, or that the operation of the program will be uninterrupted or error-free. However, Cosmotronic Software Unlimited, Inc. warrants the diskette on which the program is furnished to be of black color and square shape under normal use for a period of 90 days from the date of purchase. The joke, of course, is that the production phase, in which the actual copy of the program is produced, is not where anyone expects there to be a problem. In comparison to traditional manufacturing, software barely has a production phase at all, and programming is really design. But software does have challenges of interchangeable parts. As for traditional manufacturing, you want to be able to have different people work on different parts and know that they will fit together when complete. And for this, you need specifications. Agile methods, such as extreme programming, advocate a more fluid style of development, rather like traditional manufacturing before the Industrial Revolution, in which the members of the team work closely together and have to jiggle the parts to make them fit. And in some applications, that approach can work well. But if you're building a very big system, or if the developers building different parts work far apart and in distant time zones, you generally can't afford to have the parts not fit when you assemble them. Things are even harder if you're outsourcing some parts of a development, because then you have the cultural gap of two different companies to bridge as well. Software also has the need to interchange parts, although in a different sense from physically engineered objects. There's maintenance, the euphemism we use for replacing a part with another one when we discover that it never worked all along. And there's upgrading, in which changing a part gives the entire system some additional or improved functionality. This interchanging of parts can be done by the user with plugins, and in many systems happens even as they execute. What's the shape of a specification for a software part? Since software parts themselves come in many different forms, likewise specifications do too. So we'll talk about one particular kind of software part, the procedure, also known as a function or method or routine. When the task of building a procedure is given to an implementer, what should the client put in the specification? And what should she not put in the specification? The key challenge is that the client has to say enough to be sure that the procedure will fit in the intended context and will do the right thing, but not so much that she ties the hands of the implementer. You may have been wondering when separation of concerns would finally come up. Well, here it is. There's the concern of what the procedure does and the concern of how it works. The client only cares about what the component does. The implementer has to worry about how to make it achieve that. It's the specification that makes this separation of concerns possible. In my earlier podcast on abstract data types, we talked about one aspect of this, namely representation independence. Here we're going to talk about another important aspect, how to specify behavior. Say the procedure we're trying to specify is a procedure that looks up a string in an array and returns the index of the matching element. This is not precise enough as a description to be a specification, so we might give an overview of the steps the procedure has to perform. Check each element of the array in turn, incrementing a count as you go along, until the element matches the argument, and then return the count. And if you hit the end first, throw an exception, and so on. At first sight, this might seem to be a better candidate for a specification, but it's actually worse. This kind of skeleton ties the hands of the implementer. Why does she have to search forwards rather than backwards? And suppose she knows the array is sorted and can actually do a much more efficient binary search instead. Now you might say, well, it doesn't have to follow the skeleton exactly, it just has to have the same effect. But then imagine being the poor reviewer from QA with a pile of skeletons like this and a pile of procedures that don't quite match them. How will you ever know whether they match? There's a better approach, invented long ago in the late 1960s, by the Turing Award winner Tony Hoare and by other researchers. The idea is that instead of saying anything about the steps the procedure takes, you just say how you would expect the output to relate to the input. In this case, for example, you might say that if the procedure returned some index I, and if you looked up the ith element of the array, it would match the input string. Or if it throws an exception, the string does not appear anywhere in the array. This property relating the output to the input is called a postcondition. A specification can have a precondition too. The precondition states a condition that must hold when the procedure is called. For example, our procedure might have a precondition that the string is in the array. In that case, we can drop the part in the postcondition about the exception. If the precondition doesn't hold, then the procedure can do anything it likes. If you think of these conditions as obligations, there's a nice duality. The client is responsible for the precondition and gets the benefit of the postcondition. The implementer is responsible for the postcondition and gets the benefit of the precondition. A precondition is a kind of disclaimer. It's like when a toaster comes with a warranty saying, "This toaster will make toast from bread of these dimensions, but should not be used in a bathtub or shower." The part following the "but" is the precondition, or to be pedantic, its negation. If you try to make toast in your bathtub while bathing, you're not entitled to assume that the toaster will work, and in fact you're likely to kill yourself. And conversely, the toaster manufacturer doesn't need to worry about waterproofing the toaster, since the specification has an appropriate disclaimer restricting its use to sensible places like kitchens. Specifications written as pre- and post-conditions are said to be declarative, in contrast to operational specifications of the kind that we discussed when we talked about doing the procedure in a number of steps. A big advantage of declarative specifications is that they can be used very directly in testing. You can write the pre- and post-conditions as Boolean expressions and execute them in the code. The precondition check ensures that the client set things up correctly before the call, The post-condition check ensures that the implementer of the procedure produced the correct outcome. There's a style of programming in which pre- and post-conditions are written hand-in-hand with the code itself. It's called design by contract. Now, we've talked about the general form a specification should take, but what makes a good specification? Obviously, it should be precise and unambiguous. That's one advantage of writing it in the programming language, as in design by contract. What's less obvious is whether a specification should be tight or loose, that is, more or less constraining. Sometimes there's not much choice. For any input, only a single output is acceptable. In such cases, the specification has to be strong, constraining the implementer to return the right output. But at other times, more than one output might be acceptable, and the specification writer has to choose whether to be stronger, allowing fewer choices of output, or looser, allowing more. For example, almost any floating point computation is by necessity approximate due to truncation and rounding errors. So it makes no sense to insist that a procedure return exactly the right answer, the perfect square root, for example, because there isn't one. And even if there is a best answer, specifying what it is can be very tricky. Just look at the specification of the methods in the Java math package. Demanding the best answer can make the implementer's life very hard, and often an approximate solution can be obtained much more quickly. There's in fact an entire field of approximation algorithms research. A specification that allows more than one possible output for a given input is said to be non-deterministic. This doesn't mean that if you call the procedure, you'll actually get different outputs on different calls. It just means that the implementer is free to choose which output to return. The implementer could return different outputs on different occasions, but generally the choice of outputs is made when the code is written, so the procedure itself will always return the same output for a given input, and the procedure is said to be deterministic, even if the specification is non-deterministic. Here's another example of a loose, non-deterministic specification. Suppose you're designing a procedure that finds routes on a map. It takes a map and two endpoints and returns a path between them. Initially, you might think that the specification should say that the shortest path is returned, but that might be very expensive to compute, and is likely anyway not to correspond to the shortest traveling time. So you might write a looser specification saying that it returns a route that is within 10% of the shortest route. And one more example, this one far more subtle. What should the specification of a memory module be? The operations are very simple. They're just read, take an address and return the data at that address, and write, take an address and a data item, and put the data item at that address. I've actually just given you a strong specification. It has the property that if a write is followed by a read at the same address, it always returns the data item that was just written. Surprisingly, it turns out that for many applications of memories, this specification is far too strong. A much looser specification is typically used, not because the clients prefer it, but because it allows more efficient implementations. Take a look at the Java memory model, for example, which is loose in some very subtle and complicated ways. Or think about DNS, the domain name system. It's essentially just a memory where the addresses are domain names and the data values are IP addresses. You might think that if you register a domain name, that's the write, and then look it up immediately, that's the read, you'll get back the IP address you registered. Well, unfortunately, you won't. The DNS records need to propagate around the servers. The point is that DNS does satisfy a memory specification, but only a loose one. There's a more fundamental reason for specifications to be loose rather than strong. A specification represents a coupling between the calling and the called procedure. The stronger the specification, the more the calling procedure knows about the called procedure. This means that if you change the called procedure, the more likely you are to need to change the calling procedure. This coupling is, of course, a liability. When you make a modification to the code of a system, you're always hoping that your change will be localized and that you won't have to make a long series of compensating changes. A loose specification represents a looser coupling, and the looser the coupling, the less likely it is that a change in the call procedure will lead to a change in the caller, too. Another way to think about it is this. A specification represents an imaginary set of possible correct implementations. The looser the specification, the bigger this set. So if you want more flexibility in plugging in parts, you want the specifications to be as loose as possible. Very loose specifications play a fundamental role in many object-oriented design patterns. In the design pattern observer, for instance, the key idea is that the only thing the subject knows about the observer is that it has a method called update. And this method has a post condition requiring only that it terminate. Because the specification is so loose, the subject is compatible with any kind of observer you might want to add. And when you want to add a new kind of observer, you don't need to change the subject. The essence of the pattern is the specification of this observer object. It's this very loose specification that makes the pattern work. It's an instructive exercise to go through all the patterns in the Design Patterns book by Gamma and et al., and for each one ask what specifications are essential to the pattern. Many of the patterns are really just about loosening the specification between two objects to make them more weakly coupled. A few decades ago, Butler Lampson wrote a wonderful paper, now famous, called Hints for Computer System Design. If you haven't read it, I recommend that you do so as soon as you've finished listening to this podcast. Here's what Lampson says right at the start of the paper. The most important hints, and the vaguest, have to do with obtaining the right functionality from a system. That is, with getting it to do the things you want it to do. Most of these hints depend on the notion of an interface that separates an implementation of some abstraction from the clients who use the abstraction. An interface is generally a collection of procedures, often called operations, that a component provides. Lampson uses the word to refer to the specification of those procedures. Here's how he goes on to define it. The interface between two programs consists of the set of assumptions that each programmer needs to make about the other program in order to demonstrate the correctness of his program. And then Lampson continues. Defining interfaces is the most important part of system design. Usually, it is also the most difficult, since the interface design must satisfy three conflicting requirements. An interface should be simple, it should be complete, and it should admit a sufficiently small and fast implementation. This is very useful advice. Let's take each of these criteria in turn. By simple, Lampson doesn't mean that the functionality provided by the component is simple. He means that instead of having a large number of complex procedures, an interface should have a few simple and powerful ones that can be combined in many useful ways. This might mean a bit more programming for the client, but it's much better. When you're designing an interface, you shouldn't try and guess what the client will want to do and provide special purpose operations. You'll almost certainly get it wrong, and anyway, your interface won't be good for other clients if you do that. And you should avoid the temptation to define composite operations. For example, suppose you're designing an interface for an address book. A good interface would include operations such as adding an entry, deleting an entry, and looking up a name. An example of a bad composite operation might be one that looks up an entry and, if found, deletes it. There's no need for such an operation, since the client can always do the lookup and then the deletion. By complete, Lampson means that the set of operations that the interface provides should let clients access all the functionality of the component. It's much easier to be complete with simple operations. If you make complex operations, it's easy to miss things. Finally, Lampson says the interface should admit a sufficiently small and fast implementation. What he's saying is that when you design an interface, it's easy to get carried away and design the perfect interface. Perfect in every respect, except that it can't be built at all, or can't be built easily, or can't be built so that it runs fast enough to be useful. That's all I have to say about specifications for now. We've talked about interchangeable parts and how specifications make them possible. We've talked about the two sides of a specification, the client that uses the component and the implementer that implements it. We've talked about pre- and post-conditions and why loose specifications are better than strong specifications. And finally, We looked at some of Butler-Lampson's criteria for good specifications. Next time, we'll jump up a level and we'll talk about relationships between components and how to structure a system with many components.
Copyright 2010, Daniel Jackson. Music copyright 2010, Chris Bremer from pianosociety.com.